First of all, Mrs. Main, I'd like very much to know whether you were a native of Wisconsin mm-hmm. and where you grew up.
I am a native of Wisconsin, and I grew up about 3 years up in Adams County in the center of the state. Then we moved to Madison in 1910. And I lived in Madison until 1962.
So you went to school here?
Yes, mm-hmm. through high school.
Then what did you do?
Then I started working at the, First National Bank years ago, and the Central Wisconsin Trust Company down on the square. And I was secretary to the vice president there. And then from there, I went out to the university in ag engineering to substitute during vacation period. And from there, I was asked to come over to Extension Division when the secretary to the dean was on vacation. And after I finished that month there in that office, they asked me to stay on as secretary of the English department.
This is Extension English?
Extension, mm-hmm. And then after that, I came up to the president's office, 1927.
How did you happen to go to the president's office?
There was need for someone, apparently, to take dictation directly to the typewriter. And one girl who was in the office at the time she was very nervous, and it upset her to take dictation directly to the typewriter. I didn't know that was what I was going to be doing when I got there, but Mr. Frank asked me to bring in my typewriter, and he started dictating, and I started typing. That's the way it went from then on.
Had you expected to take
regular dictation, shorthand? Yes. Mm-hmm.
Well, are you saying that you just typed it directly and you never had a chance to correct it or anything?
Yes, we corrected. He did all correspondence as well as his speeches. And the speeches we did with 9 carbon copies and an original.
On one typewriter?
On one typewriter.
Manual
typewriter.
Wasn't that awfully hard on your fingers?
It was hard. But when Mr. Frank ordered a new typewriter to be taken out to the study of the president's house, he asked if I would keep it at the office to break it in so he could type on it the same as the action on my typewriter at the office. Because he did lots of typing himself.
So they were pretty much identical typewriters?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. What kind was it?
Old Underwoods.
Oh, my. Well, what was it like in the president's, in Glenn Frank's office?
It was a very interesting period because we had so many visitors from away, a great many very distinguished people. Mr. Frank, of course, had been affiliated with Mr. Filene in Boston, in the East.
Oh, yes, I'm
and
familiar
Mr.
with
Filene came out
his name.
And was a guest at the house, and I went up and took his dictation when he was there.
Mr. Filene, I think, had a department store in Boston. Oh, there is one.
Well, and he was the head of CUNA. You know.
Oh, was he? I didn't know that.
That was his main interest. And it was not too long after he came out that our CUNAs, faculty credit union started.
So he had some connection with getting the credit union
I don't
going?
Know just exactly whether he really started it or whether someone here contacted the other people in CUNA and worked out our arrangement here, but it was very satisfactory.
Well, that's very interesting. What other people came?
I cannot remember which one of the Secretary of State, United States Secretary of State, came, and he was a house guest. And I can't remember which one it was, but I went out and took his dictation. He was a very tall man, very distinguished. And we had tea, some little treats out in the study while he dictated.
Also to the typewriter? Or did you take
stenographic notes? I took shorthand notes and brought them back to the office and transcribed. he was a very, very pleasant person. I was frightened when I went out there that day. It just kind of bowled me over to think that I was going to be taking dictation from him, and I was afraid.
That is a little unexpected, I guess. Mm-hmm. Did you go out to the house often to do this kind of thing?
Yes, we did. We went out often. If there was something that needed to be done and to get away from telephone interruptions, then we'd go out to the house and I'd take the dictation out there. Mr. Frank would walk up and down the study and dictate. And that's where he dictated the gist of the budget for the legislature. Little book, it was about an inch thick when it was finished, typewritten, mimeographed. And he have the legislators knowledgeable about what the university needs were for the next biennium. So it required a lot of figures that he had to have, and for that reason, he had Mr. Phillips, who was then the business manager of the university, come out to fill him in on the figures.
Now, this must have happened every couple of years, then.
Yes. Well, no, really not. That was the way he handled it the first year when I was there and did that work. I don't know how it was done before that, because Mr. Frank came in 25.
That's right.
And
well, how about later years?
Then later on, they handled it in other manners. There was more work done down at the business office in preparing it, and then the president would have his own statement to present.
I see.
Mm-hmm. But they did the financial angle. Financial section of it.
Well, even in those years, that must have been fairly complicated.
It was. There were lots of details that had to be followed. That was one thing. There were many, many details in the office, and there never was a day that was the same as the day before. It was always changing.
What kind of things went on?
Well, the visitors that came up, or we might have a student problem, or there might be a faculty difficulty of some type, and it was always one little thing or the other that we had to switch from one project to another in very short order and get things done.
I have the feeling that possibly the president's office was more accessible to the campus at large than perhaps it is today.
Yes, it was very accessible. Our door was just inside the south entrance to Bascom Hall, and we had the big regent meeting room. There were two of us in that room, and we had our desks over by the windows. As a matter of fact, our desks were two little old roll-top desks that were taken out of the old Capitol and had been stored away, and they had refinished them and brought them up to put in that office. And then for our typewriter, we had a metal cabinet that was on casters that we could roll around. So when the regents came, we'd fold up everything and take it out into Miss Wilkinson's office and do our work out there, so that the regents had the meeting room all open to themselves.
Oh, I see. So when the regents weren't meeting,
we worked in the regent meeting room, actually.
I see.
Mm-hmm. Well, we had a huge table. I understand when they took the table out that they had to cut it in two to take it out and get it away from the building.
Gracious, I wonder how they got it in.
I don't know. I wasn't there when they brought it.
Same way, perhaps. Well, now you mentioned Miss Wilkinson, and I'm very anxious to have you talk about her.
Well, I guess I think I told you that she was there starting in 1903.
That would have been with President Van
Hise. President Van Hise, uh-huh. And then, of course, Dr. Burge followed President Van Hise, and then Mr. Frank.
Well, so she was there a very
long time. She was there until 1943.
Oh, well, that was a long, long mm-hmm. time.
40 years.
Well, Mr. Baldwin has told me that Miss Wilkinson was practically an assistant president.
She was. And the faculty people came to her with their problems many, many times. And they would discuss them with her, and if she didn't have an answer for them, she'd arrange an appointment for them to come back and talk with the president if it was necessary. She had grown with the university from the time it was a small institution. And, I think when I came, it was about 12,000 registration. And you can see what it's grown to since then.
Well, we're, what is it, 41,000
now? Yes,
now?
Over 40. But she worked very closely with President Van Hise. She would go in the morning, and there were no appointments until he had had a chance to go through his mail and dictate. And then from then on, of course, she would be out at her desk. And as a matter of fact, at that time, when she first came, she was also in that Regent meeting room. And I think they used a part of that room way back when for a registrar's office.
Oh, it must have been a good sized room.
It was a large room, but there was a bench along one wall, and then they had a sort of a barrier that with windows, you know, for people to answer students as they came in if they had need for some help. But Mr. Van Hise evidently gave her lots of information about what was happening at the university and kept her abreast of all the activities, and so that she knew exactly what was going on. And she was there so long with so many of the staff. They all knew her very well. And it's, as you say, the office was open for people to come in, and she was the first contact, of course. So that many people depended upon her advice.
Did she comment at all about changes when the presidents changed?
You mean a new president came?
Mm-hmm.
No, she just felt that we had to make our adjustments, and of course, if they wanted to bring someone else in our place, we would have to step aside. So we always hoped that we'd be kept on.
Well, I gather your hopes were justified.
Yes, for the length of time I was there. And then, of course, when Miss Wilkinson passed away so suddenly in the office, I was the only one who had been there any length of time. So I stayed there, of course, and to help, to do everything I could. And then Mr. Dykstra asked me if I wouldn't take the civil service exam to qualify for Secretary to the President or civil service classification. And I did that, and then when Mr. Fred became president, he decided to make me an administrative assistant. So that's what I was when I retired.
Now, did this carry some sort of faculty status?
No. No, we were always
still
on
civil
service.
Still civil service. Mm-hmm. Well, tell me a little bit about what kind of person Miss Wilkinson was.
She was very, very congenial. As I mentioned the other day when we talked, she would open the door and come in singing, "I've got spurs that jingle, jangle, jingle," and go back to her office and get all settled for the day's work. And she'd always say, "If you have any questions, come to me. Don't guess at anything." And she was very strict about finding records. If we had to look up something in the old files down in the basement, where the files were kept from, I believe, 1883, and we came up and said we couldn't find it, she'd say, "There's no such word as can't in our vocabulary in this office. We've got to find it." And we'd go back down and look, because we cross-referenced everything, all the correspondence. If there was any subject matter discussed in a letter, that was cross-referenced in every means possible, so that we would have some way of looking it up. And if we couldn't find the letter, if we found a cross-reference, sometimes it would lead us to another cross-reference, and eventually we'd find the material we needed.
Sounds like it sometimes it took a lot of time.
It was very, very old-fashioned, I guess, but that was our filing system.
Well, did you have a lot of space down in the...
We had a room down there that was had shelving, and these filing boxes were all in order down there, chronological order, so that we could find them.
Sounds like a miniature archive.
It was. But I think it's wonderful that they've got it in the archives now. They've moved it all.
I think it's better protected there.
Yes. And so much of the material, some of the old, not mimeographed, but the old carbon copies were getting so faint, and then the paper was getting so brittle, that when we'd handle it, the corners would crumble, you know, and fall off. And then the silverfish got in, and they ate the binding on the boxes, so when we'd pull a box out, we'd have to be careful, or it would just form a fan of the correspondence for us.
Well, of course, everything that goes into the archives is fumigated if there's this kind of problem.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of the big horrors of an archivist, is to let anything like that get into his storage areas.
Yes.
You said that Miss Wilkinson died in the office. Could you tell me what happened?
She came in that morning and said she didn't feel well. She had a bad headache. And she went downstairs. We had a little office space down there with a couch. And she went down to that during the morning. But she came back up again, said she felt some better. And she went down at noon to have her lunch, which she always had her little sandwich and tea.
And there was a hot plate or something?
A hot plate downstairs. She could heat the water. And she had her food and then lay down to rest for a little while. And when the other assistant in the office came back from lunch, she didn't go down, because she thought she'd disturb her if she was resting. And then Miss Riley came over from the graduate office, because she had known that she didn't feel well, to see how she was feeling, if she was better. And she went down and found that she'd had a coronary and she'd passed away. But
how difficult for all of you.
Yes. And no one knew where to start, you know, that to do things. It was because she'd always had her finger on everything. We all depended upon her so much. But we finally got things moving along again. That was during Mr. Dykstra's administration.
I see.
In 43. So.
But at least he was not new at the same time that you had to take
over. No, he was, and he was very, very considerate and knew that we were trying to go on under difficult times.
Well, I understand that you knew the Franks quite well.
Well, I suppose I knew them next to Miss Wilkinson as well as anyone who was in the office, because I did go out to the house to take dictation so often. And I enjoyed both Mr. and Mrs. Frank very much. She was a very clever person, and she could write things. She could write beautiful things. As a matter of fact, she wrote a tribute to Miss Wilkinson that's been framed and is in the corridor down in Chadron Hall, where her photograph is also hung.
And nice.
It's a very beautiful memorial for her. Not long, but very much to the point. And she was a person who liked her close friends, but didn't go out. She wasn't a real outgoing person.
Well, I've heard many different things about her. I rather have the feeling that, and this fits with what you said, that a lot of the faculty didn't seem very close to her. There was,
well,
she was criticized some.
They really didn't get to know her, because she wasn't the outgoing person that, well, Mrs. Dykstra, for instance, was much more outgoing than Mrs. Frank. But she used to write beautifully. She wrote, I'm not sure about the article. She did write an article about girls joining sororities.
Oh, did she?
There was an article. Now, I don't know where it was published. I can't recall. But she felt that the way the initiations were, not initiations, but the choosing of the girls.
Pledging
was handled, was very, very difficult for lots of girls, and it made a great deal of difference in their feeling toward staying at the university and continuing on with their studies. I think she herself had been a member of a sorority when she was in college, but she evidently knew how it had hurt some of the girls when they weren't pledged, and
that's
the difference it had made in their life.
It's interesting. She should have written about that that early, because it's before the great criticism that since developed,
mm-hmm,
about,
mm-hmm,
fraternities and sororities.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's true.
Is it true that she used to go for walks in the,
yes,
country with her chauffeur following behind
she
in the car?
She used to walk many, many, many times. I don't know, I wouldn't have any idea of just exactly how often, but one of the doctors suggested that would be a good way for her to get out and get exercise, and get out in the air. And
why did she go with
car
and chauffeur following?
They thought, being the wife of the president, that it was just a safety measure to have the car follow her.
In other words, that she wouldn't be alone.
Mm-hmm. Because he'd drive her out, and then she'd walk back toward town, and and he'd follow.
Well, that is interesting. Did she do, as a wife of the president, did she do much entertaining?
She entertained, she always had a large luncheon whenever they had the honorary degrees at commencement time. And that was one of the biggest things. And of course, whenever any out-of-state visitor came or some prominent person came to the university, she would have dinners for them. Not real often, but whenever it was, but she felt it was necessary. And then she did have a bridge party and luncheon out at the Maple Bluff Country Club for the wives of the legislators one year, as a matter of public relations, I expect.
That's a nice thought.
They all seemed to enjoy it, being out there, and they had transportation arranged for them to get out to the country club. And they all had a very nice time.
But this only happened once?
That was just, yes, just the one time.
Mm-hmm. That does sound like good public relations, doesn't it?
And of course, they used to have the reception, you know, for the students and their parents at commencement time. That was quite an ordeal, because by the time they got through shaking hands with all those people, it was a lot of standing. So many of the president's wives said that that was one of the hardest things they had to do, stand in receiving line.
For that long a time.
For that long period. And their hands, their right hand would get pretty tired, pretty sore.
I guess I'll be interested in what you recall of the circumstances surrounding the firing of Glenn Frank. But before that, are there any other events during that time that stand out in your memory?
Well, it was during his period that, was it? I think it was during his administration that the football coach was fired.
Do you remember which one?
Clarence Little. And I can't remember just exactly when that was, but I'm sure it was in Mr. Frank's administration. And we had a lot of trouble with reporters trying to get information ahead of time and speculating on who was going to be the next coach. And one of the reporters tried to get up close enough to the office door from the basement office. And we don't know how he got in, unless he got in through a window down into the basement, to see if he could hear anything that would be news for his paper.
Oh, goodness. All's fair for the press.
Then when Mr. Frank was told that the regents were thinking about asking him to leave, we were all upset, of course, and at the regent meeting, the regents were divided so that it was almost impossible to tell about which way they would vote, because some of it had to do with their political affiliations.
Oh.
And their political background. But Mr. La Follette had been in as governor and had, he'd been in office, then he was defeated, but he returned to office again. And in that way, the Board of Regents was had more people who belonged to the governor's party than any other party.
Oh, I see.
So it was a case of a vote of 8-7, and we had a 15-member board at that time. And after that, they changed the number of regents. I believe it's 9 now instead of 15.
What were the circumstances that, insofar as you were concerned, that led up to this?
Well, I don't know exactly. When Mr. Frank was told, of course, that this was a possibility, that there would be something coming up at the next regent meeting, we had to be prepared, so that he decided that he would make a statement. And I went out to the house, and he dictated his remarks that he planned to make, and then they took them back to the office and got a stencil and had the mimeograph so that they could pass them out to the reporters' press that was there.
Do you recall?
We never were in the room when the regents were meeting. We were out in the office where Miss Wilkinson had her desk, so that we didn't know exactly when they told him.
Do you recall what the major issues were that were under discussion?
Well, it was the faculty was not happy with him. There was a certain faction of the faculty that was against him, and they didn't like the fact that he had brought Mr. Micklejohn in with his experimental college ideas, and it was hard to put your finger on anything, really. That as far as we were concerned, we couldn't tell. But we just had to go along and get the statement ready. it was an awful ordeal.
Well, it must have been. What happened after that?
Well, after they had Regents had taken their action, they just flew out of the office as fast as they could go, and the students had all gathered, and they had there were windows along one side of the office where the Regents met that they had to open because there were so many people, there were so many from the press there, and it was getting uncomfortable for the Regents to sit. Well, the students were all there in protest against the firing of Mr. Frank, and he went out and talked to them. Well, that wasn't enough. They all marched down State Street, right down to the governor's office, into the governor's office, asked for some explanation. They realized that it was had a lot to do with the governor, that the reason that Mr. Frank was no longer wanted at the university.
Well, I understand there was quite a bit of publicity over this whole,
yes,
whole affair.
All sort. We had just stacks and stacks of clippings. We had a clipping service, and we just had all kinds of clippings. We had to classify them and sort them and file them for a while. But we worked all night the night before the hearing, the actual hearing. They had had a meeting one day, and then that the night of the first day of the meeting, we worked all night preparing the statement for Mr. Frank to read.
Nine copies.
Yes, and they tried to storm the back door where we were in Miss Wilkinson's office, and it took three or four men to hold the door. We were afraid even then they were pushing so hard that they'd break the door down from the outside. They were trying to get in to protest, but we didn't want any kind of a riot type of thing to happen.
Did Glenn Frank leave right away? I mean, did he leave the office?
He never came back into the office after he left that day.
He didn't?
Never. We had to pack up everything in the office and have it taken out to the house.
So he never even cleaned out his own things?
Never
cleaned
that. No. Dean Salary came in as acting president and took over the office at 8 o'clock the next morning, and didn't give us a chance to even look at his desk.
Gracious.
He started dictating to Miss Wilkinson right away, put his feet on the president's desk, and made her very unhappy. So. She thought it was not a very dignified way for a president to act. She'd never had one do that before. Put his feet up on the desk, yeah.
Well, it sounds like a rather abrupt change.
It was.
Now, how long was Salary acting president? Do you remember?
I don't remember exactly, but I don't think it was much more than 6 months. Maybe even three.
Before Mr. Dykstra came.
Mm-hmm.
Before I talk about Mr. Dykstra a little bit more, I'm wondering, you did refer to the experimental college, and I knew that the 5 years that this went was a very controversial thing.
Yes, that was very well set up by the time I came in. That had been started quite a bit before I started there. So I didn't learn too much about exactly what their experiment was really going to be. So I really can't talk about that.
Well, did some of these problems that turned up in the president's office have something to do with the experimental college?
Well, I think the fact that he had brought Mr. Micklejohn in was a sour note to some of the faculty. And I can't say exactly why. I really don't know.
Did you know Mr. Micklejohn?
He used to come to the office frequently. But I never knew him as well as I knew some of the other professors who came into the office.
Did you, well, again, thinking about President Frank, did you know his son, Glennie?
Yes.
Very well?
Mm-hmm. I didn't have too much to do with Glennie because he had, I can't remember the name of the young man who was a student who lived at the house, Ward. I thought of his name the other day. slipped again. Well, anyway, Ward was a student, and he lived at the house, and they had their rooms at one end by themselves. And whenever Glennie would go anywhere, Ward usually went with him.
I see.
So he was... then one day, I got on a scooter of some kind, and he went down the hill, broke both arms.
Oh, my.
He was in terrible shape for a while. You know, of course, being a youngster, they healed. He was all right, but they felt so badly for him because there wasn't anything he could do. You know, he couldn't hold a book to read or anything.
Not with both of them.
No.
All right. What was it like when Mr. Dykstra took over?
It was a very easy transition, really. He came in and things just started going along as usual, and he was a very, very easy person to work with. He did get an Ediphone to dictate to rather than dictating to a stenographer.
He didn't dictate to the typewriter the way.
No, he didn't. The typewriter days were over. and he was a very pleasant person, and Mrs. Dykstra was a very pleasant person too, and took over very easily, and it was really, the transition was as smooth as anything could possibly be after such an ending, you know, for the other administration. Mrs. Dykstra was very capable out of the house. She always answered her own telephone most of the time. I remembered what I was trying to tell you the other day. She'd say, "This is Mrs. Dykstra." Mr. Dykstra said to her, "Someday you're going to say, 'Mrs., this is Dykstra.'" I don't think she ever did.
Well, it sounds plausible, though.
And they, as a matter of fact, they kept on the help that they'd had at the house, the girl who was the cook and the girl who was the maid. And just the same as if the Franks were still there.
Well, that would have made for an easy transition, I would imagine.
The girls were very helpful to her, I'm sure. We had to do a few rearrangement of things at the house, naturally, because the Franks had brought some of their furniture with them, and then the Dykstras refurnished some of the things. They brought some of their own things too, of course.
I heard that the Franks stayed in the President's house until through the spring. They didn't leave. They didn't move out.
No, they didn't move right away. Not until they bought their home out in Maple Bluff. And of course, it took a little while. I believe the house that they bought out there was a new house. And they had to get carpeting and things like that, as I recall, before they could move the things in.
Well, I think I heard from Mrs. Dykstra, I believe she said that they had to stay somewhere temporarily before they could move into the President's home.
Yes, I think they did, and I don't remember. Did they stay down at the Union? I think perhaps they stayed at the Union.
I believe she said they did.
I recall. That's where they stayed. But it wasn't too long a period because they tried to get out as quickly as they could.
What, were there any significant changes in the office?
No.
Did Mr. Dykstra institute anything?
No, the office remained just about the same all during his administration. I can't remember anything except his changing the Ediphone instead of dictating.
What was he like as a person to work with?
very, very pleasant. Never any criticism of us at all. I can't remember him ever criticizing anything or being sharp about anything or saying we should have done something differently from the way we had done it. I suppose that was due a good deal to Miss Wilkinson being there.
It could well have been.
He left. He came in 37. He left in 45, was it?
I believe, because 45? That's when Edwin Fred started in 45.
Mm-hmm. That was when he had his appointment to in California.
Well, now, what can you tell me about his leaving? There's less really said about that.
Well, it was just that he had this offer to come out there as was he chancellor? I don't know.
I forget the title.
I can't remember his title myself right now. But anyway, he had lived at Laguna Beach, and he loved it out there. And that's where he wanted to go back to live. And they lived there. I don't know just where his official residence was when he was out there, but that was where they lived as much as they possibly could. And that was where he was fighting a brush fire and had a heart attack.
Oh, yes, I'd forgotten that.
Mm-hmm. They came back once to visit, and he opened the door. And I was out, at that time I was in the office where Miss Wilkinson had been, and I came out to meet him and shake hands, and he was tall, he was over 6 feet. He came down and he kept saying, "Lola, Lola, Lola." And when he met me, he put his arms around me, and I went, you know, he was up here and I was way down here. And Mr. Luberg came out. He that was when he was with Mr. Fred, and he looked at Mr. Dexter and looked at me as if, well, what's going on? I laughed afterward. But he seemed happy to come back for a little visit here that time. And that was the last time he was back, at least that I happened to see him.
No, I have understood that there was, again, regent pressure, but not to
there
the
there was some regent pressure,
that,
but no.
That there had no. been with Glenn Frank.
That's right. I don't know just exactly what the... it seemed to stem from faculty unrest.
Faculty unrest?
Yes, they seemed to be, you know... The faculty seemed to divide always on every presidency. Not on Mr. Fred's, but when Mr. Frank was here and when Mr. Dykstra was here. There seemed to be two factions in the faculty, one for and one against.
That's curious.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it has been pointed out to me that these are both people who came here from outside the university,
mm-hmm.
and it's been suggested that one of Mr. Fred's advantages was the fact he came from within.
Yes,
the institution.
I think that's very true, and people
understood it.
He'd been here so long, and he knew so many of the faculty. I think that makes a big difference. And there was criticism of Mr. Frank that he did not have a PhD.
Oh, there was, even then.
Mm-hmm.
PhDs weren't as common then.
No,
they
weren't.
Now.
And the Regents felt that evidently that he had the proper background for the position, or they wouldn't have appointed him. Zona Gale was one of the people who wanted Mr. Frank to come. She did everything she could. Dan Grady from Portage, they both lived up at Portage, Miss Zona Gale and Mr. Grady. They both did everything they could.
I've been told that he spoke very well.
He was an excellent speaker. And he had a way of putting words together that no one else did, I guess. He also had a syndicated column. I don't remember just how many papers took his material, but he wrote a syndicated column that was published, I don't know if it was once a week or whether it was one every day. I can't remember. But he did a very clever one on Santa Claus. And it was just, he said, if people tell you that you're not, that there isn't a Santa Claus, there is a Santa Claus. And then he said that his red nose showed that he was jolly, and his fat tummy showed that he was well fed and he was happy, and things were right in the world. And I just wish I'd kept a copy of that. I thought I had one, but I don't have it. It was such a pleasant thing for youngsters. Uh-huh. Of course, Glennie was small when he wrote that. It was about the age when he would, start questioning, is there a Santa Claus?
Oh, yes. Hmm. He did this then even while he was president?
Yes.
He just kept it going. Mm-hmm. Well, with or without a PhD, he had a lot of ability.
He did have a lot of ability. I know that the housekeeper that he had for his, I don't know whether it was his mother or his father that was still living down in Missouri, but she knew him from a little boy. And she said when he was a little boy, he'd get a kitchen chair, stand on the kitchen chair, and take the Bible, and he'd stand and give a sermon. And they thought he was going to be a minister. But of course he went into other things. He went into the editing the Atlantic Journal?
Monthly?
Atlantic Monthly, yeah. Mm-hmm. That was what he was doing when they brought him to the university.
Well, then following Clarence Dykstra, Edwin Fred mm-hmm. became president. Mm-hmm. Now, I know that it wasn't too long after he became president that he did make some changes in the administrative setup of the office, did he not?
He wanted Eleanor to be in the back office next to his office. And we had one person out in the outer office to answer phones. And I moved over with Mr. Baldwin, supposedly to take care of correspondence and to boil it down as much as we could to save him from having to pay much attention to correspondence that came in.
I see. Now, when did Eleanor come?
She came, I got her soon after Miss Wilkinson passed away. I think she came about 43.
Before Mr. Fred became president?
No, it was after he became president. One of the girls that I had in the office at that time she'd applied for a job downtown at one of the banks, and she went down there. Her husband was in graduate school. And she gave me 2 weeks' notice. So I had to start scouting around to find somebody, and I got Elner from Ag Journalism. And Professor Hopkins was not very happy with me. I think if I met him on the street, he'd probably still tell me he wasn't very happy with
me. Andrew Hopkins?
That was when Elner came, and I worked with Dr. Baldwin. We did a lot of things over there. Of course, I did all the work for the preparing for regent meetings.
Oh, you did?
That was my job, to get all recommendations for faculty appointments together. And all the gifts and grants we got, I mimeographed all those every month for the regent meetings. And my work became more administrative, as far as taking care of the requisitions and ordering new things if we had to have them for the office or the house.
Oh, you took care of the house problems of that
house
store, too?
Yes, requisitions for things that were needed. If a freezer was worn out and we had to replace it, we'd have get some advice on it and find out if it could be fixed or if it should be replaced. And then if we had the money in the budget, we'd write the requisitions.
Did you have any work to do with the budget?
No, I never had too much work to do on the budget. The only thing I had to do was payroll, really.
Oh, yes.
For the office.
Well, now the versus staff, that I think is when we began to get, when we first had a vice president. Mr. Baldwin was the first vice president. Mm-hmm.
Yes, when Mr. Fred was president.
And then Mr. Luberg,
we had never had.
I guess he was an administrative assistant too, wasn't he?
Well, he was more than an administrative assistant. He came in place of Frank Holt, who was more or less a liaison officer between the university and the legislature.
Oh, I see.
Frank Holt had been registrar before that.
Yes, I knew that.
Mm-hmm. And Mr. Luberg did much of the contact with the legislature.
Well, he has continued doing a lot in the public relations area.
Mm-hmm. And then, of course, Mr. Fred had Scott Cutler on public relations for a while. But then he went back teaching.
Did you do much work with either Mr. Cutluck or Mr. Luberg?
No, not too much. Mr. Luberg had Emily Peterson as his secretary when he was had his little office down in Bascom.
Oh, I see.
And that was entirely separate. They worked with us, but I mean they were a separate unit.
What stands out in your mind about President Fred's time?
Well, I just don't know what to say. He was the kind of a person, when he dictated, would give you about three sentences that meant the same thing, and you just have to take your notes and read them and decide which way to say it.
He left you to decide?
Well, yes.
To choose?
Yes. And another job he handed me that wasn't very a happy one was taking care of out-of-state travel for the university staff, getting approval from the governor's office and getting the approval back to the staff members. they had been doing it in the business office, and they were very unhappy with the way it was being handled, especially the people in medical school, and a lot of them over in agriculture too. And see, there are limitations on how many can go except to certain things. I've forgotten the limitations actually, but there were limitations. And if more than one person was going, you had to have a written reason for that sort of thing. So we had to work with the governor's office on that all the time. And another job that he gave me was drafting a letter of condolence when a staff member died. I'd have to draft it and do it in yellow and double space so that he could write what he thought he'd like to add or take out, that sort of thing. Those are the things that he gave me to do that I'd never done before and I didn't enjoy too much.
Neither one.
Neither one. No. He worked entirely different from any of the presidents.
How do you mean?
Because I think it's because of his research background. He would give you something to look up and you'd get all the information you could get, and then somebody else would call you and ask you if you'd gotten any information together for Dr. Fred about the same subject, and finally you kind of throw your hands in the air and said, well, I'm through. If you're looking too, I've got all I can get. So he wasn't an easy person to work with.
He wasn't?
No, because you'd get everything done and think everything was in good order, and he'd say, well, did you ask so-and-so about some other aspect of this? And you'd have to start all over with some other idea. And it didn't always seem really important, and it would come back to being the same thing that you'd started with many times. But I think it's because of his research mind that he had, that he just wasn't satisfied with the first thing he got. He did that with everybody. I wasn't the only one.
And you wanted to search out all the possibilities.
Yeah, everything under the sun.
Well, did you find yourself taking work home?
No, I never did take work home with me. We always got our work done at the office and put it out of our minds until the next day.
Well, you did mention staying up all night getting...
Well, yes, we...
But that was unusual.
That was an unusual time, that work.
Oh, I'm getting back to Glenn Frank. I was meaning to ask you if you remembered who in the faculty were supporting him. Who came to the office?
Well, there weren't many of the College of Letters and Science who supported him.
Right.
Mr. Fred stood by him, and Mr. Holt stood by him. Mr. Scheidler from French department was always right there. Mr. Kiekhofer. There were a great many who were very loyal to him, but there were some others that were very much against him. I remember Mr. Fred and Mr. Holt, especially during the days when the regents were meeting there, and they knew this thing was going on, that they were trying to be as helpful as they could, offering help to us if we needed it, you know, in the office.